Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Well, hello there and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scarsbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. On the menu today,
when rising to heaven becomes a gift for composers Palestrina and Taverner and for artist Daniele da Volterra. Here lies one whose name was writ in water, Keats and Shelley, united in death here in Rome. But first, we enjoy a conversation with a popular Dominican preacher. Stay tuned.
You'll have heard of him, no doubt. He's an award-winning writer, but above all, a preacher, who's very much in demand these days. You may have guessed he's the former Master General of the Dominican Order, Timothy Radcliffe. I must say I was privileged enough to sit down with him between lectures here in Rome, in the very place St. Dominic once walked, Santa Sabina on the Aventine Hill, enjoying a rather informal chat, during which I began by asking him how he wanted to be introduced to you. Let's listen.
I'm an itinerant preacher, or as some of my brethren say, a perambulating windbag. I still spend about 8 months a year travelling, preaching, lecturing, giving retreats. I come home occasionally to wash my clothes and prepare for my next trip.
Being a preacher today isn't always an easy task. The word preaching in the past used to have sort of very noble connotations. Today, perhaps, when one says, oh, stop preaching, or practice what you preach, that sort of thing. Do you find it difficult to belong to the order of preachers today?
Yes and no. It's certainly true that people assume that if you're preaching, you're talking at people. You're not talking with them. And ideally, I think, that the first thing that any preacher does is to listen. You arrive, you hear how people talk, you hear what concerns them, and you try to understand, if you want, their whole way of speaking and thinking and being, and then you will know better how to share the Word of God with them. So it can be slightly difficult being an itinerant preacher, because you turn up and you talk often before you've got to know people, and that's a challenge. But I think, on the other hand, there is a tremendous thirst for the Word of God. And even people who don't believe, even people who are quite hardened against religion, are often quite keen to engage in a conversation.
People are ready to believe, in a sense, aren't they? In fact, people turn to other religions, Eastern religions. For some reason, the Christian message doesn't seem to come across so well today. It doesn't seem so exciting to people, does it? So how would you make that exciting?
I think that's very often because people think that they know what Christianity is about, when they don't. And so one of the first things we have to try to do is to disclose its freshness. I've been studying the Bible, I suppose, pretty continuously for about 45 years. And one of the things that astonishes me is it's always fresh. Every time I have to preach and I look at a text, which perhaps I've preached on 20 times, I'm always surprised. There's always something new. So I think part of what you want to do is to share with your hearers your sense of surprise. That it's always new. God is always new.
God is always new, but people are really interested in their own experience, no, today. They look very much inwards. It's yourself for yourself. That's the culture we live in, isn't it, in the 21st century?
I think that's largely true. It's very concerned with the subjective. And what we have to do is, at the same time, acknowledge a concern with somebody's own subjective experience, what they lived through, to let them tell their story. But, of course, always the excitement of faith is that you're invited to discover something objective, something which is true throughout the ages, something which liberates you from self-absorption. Because ultimately, if you remain completely self-absorbed, then you're stuck in a boring little prison of yourself. And so part of the excitement of faith is being liberated into this larger world of other people, and ultimately, of course, the larger world of God.
I'd like to go back to something that Pope Benedict said at the inauguration mass, which I think is rather interesting, particularly for priests. He invites the pastor to be inspired by Christ's holy zeal.
La santa inquietudine di Cristo deve animare il pastore. Per lui non è indifferente che tante
persone. For him, it is not a matter of indifference that so many people are living in the desert. There are so many kinds of desert. There is the desert of poverty, the desert of hunger and thirst, the desert of abandonment, of loneliness, of destroyed love. There is the desert of God's darkness, the emptiness of souls, no longer aware of their dignity or the goal of human life. The external deserts in the world are growing because the internal deserts have become so vast.
Perché i deserti interiori sono diventati così ampi?
Would you agree with that? That the internal deserts have become so vast?
I think it's brilliantly put. I think to make that link, if you want, between the ecological challenge of a world with growing deserts with the internal deserts is brilliant. And I think often, you know, what's most oppressive for people is to be caught in a world of banality. It's the trivialization of so much experience. Every one of us lives through dramatic and extraordinary events of birth and death, of suffering, of falling in love. And what the gospel offers is a way into these, which is in contrast with the banalization which is so apparent in our own society.
How do people experience prayer in today's world?
I think there are two elements in prayer, and they're both important. Some people will go more for one, some for another. I think that prayer involves both listening and speaking. It involves both silence and petition. Those are the two fundamental elements, and they will lead on to the third, which is praise. So I think that the beginning of all prayer is actually learning to listen. Now, sometimes before we can be attentive to God, before we can have that real silence in our center, that expectancy of a word, then we need to do a lot of talking with God. Perhaps we want to complain or get angry with God or ask God for things. And sometimes it's only after we've done this, which is so important, that we can then pause and listen. And I think there's a tremendous desire for silence. Very often people are frightened of silence, which means that often they have to begin with short moments of silence. If you put many people into a room and say, you've got to be silent now for half an hour, it would seem like a day and terrifying. So you start by offering people maybe even 5 minutes of silence, little tastes of it. And finally, you come to love it. When I became a Dominican novice, I used to dread the half hour of silent meditation. And I was always surreptitiously sort of looking at my watch and seeing how far we'd gone. And I was convinced I would burp or something and disturb all the brethren. But it took me years to actually just come to enjoy it. Now I look forward to it.
Why did you become a Dominican?
Above all, I fell in love with the motto of the order, Veritas, truth. When I was at school, I was always one of the bad boys, you know. I used to smoke behind the cricket pavilion and I knew the quickest pub you could get to, you know, where you could have a safe drink without being caught by the masters. And when I left school, for the first time, I got to know people who weren't Catholic or who weren't Christian. And the big question is it true? Is it true? And I became obsessed by this question. And then I remembered from my distant Benedictine past that there was an order which had the motto, truth. And I thought, now I must find them.
And a big thank you there to Dominican preacher and former Master General of his order, Timothy Radcliffe. Meanwhile, looking ahead to mark the Feast of the Assumption, which falls each year on the 15th of August, some very special notes for a musical comment on the fourth glorious mystery of the Rosary. That's with Monsignor Philip Whitmore.
Assumpta est Maria in
Assumpta est Maria. Mary has been assumed into heaven. The angels rejoice. They sing for joy and praise the Lord. This is what we celebrate in the fourth glorious mystery of the Rosary. Christian art loves to depict the scene with Mary borne aloft by angels, while the disciples gasp with astonishment from earth below. And any text about rising to heaven is a gift for a composer. Listen to the joyful, surging scales in Giovanni Pierluigi da Palestrina's motet, Assumpta est Maria. Palestrina's music has always been held up as a model of the most perfect form of Renaissance polyphony. He became something of a legendary figure in the 19th century among those who wanted to revive the sacred choral style of the 16th century. It's easy to see why. The classical purity of this intricate interweaving of voices seems to evoke the perfection of a bygone age, and at the same time, the glory of the world to come. For those of us living in Rome, the name Palestrina has a local ring because it's the name of a small town a short distance away, a good place to go for a day out of the city. Pope Julius III had been the Bishop of Palestrina before he was elected to the papacy, and when he moved to Rome, he brought with him his former cathedral organist, Giovanni Pierluigi. Unlike many Roman composers of the time, Palestrina was not a cleric. He was married with a family. In fact, an exception was made for him to sing in the Cappella Sistina, normally open only to celibates. He did consider entering the priesthood after his first wife died, but it was not to be, and in due course he married for a second time. The doctrine of Our Lady's Assumption has a long history, even though it was only in 1950 that it was solemnly defined as a dogma of faith by Pope Pius XII. It has a particularly venerable tradition in the Eastern churches. St. John Damascene, for example, wrote beautifully about the mystery. In the East, it's normally referred to as the Dormition of Our Lady. Let's listen now to a musical meditation on this theme for the unusual combination of string quartet and handbells, written by the living English composer John Taverner, himself a member of the Orthodox Church. It's called The Last Sleep of the Virgin. Thank you. That air of mysticism, evoked through the simplest of means, is characteristic of John Taverner. His music is deeply religious, and it often achieves its effect through constant repetition, almost like a musical mantra. That makes it seem particularly appropriate for a meditation on the rosary. I'd like to finish with one of Taverner's most important works to date. The Protecting Veil, written in 1988, is a piece for solo cello and string orchestra based on a vision of Our Lady sheltering the beleaguered Christians beneath her all-encompassing veil. In the composer's own words, the Mother of God is represented by the cello and never stops singing throughout. The accompanying string music is a gigantic extension of her unending song. We've been listening to a passage from the sixth movement entitled The Dormition of the Mother of God. And let's allow ourselves, as we listen, to be transported into contemplation of that great and glorious mystery.
Monsignor Philip Whitmore is a music historian currently working as an official at the Vatican's Secretariat of State. Now, as Monsignor Philip Whitmore mentioned, Christian art loves to depict the scene of Mary borne aloft by angels. To find one such artwork, here in Rome, you can traipse up the Spanish Steps to the landmark church of the Santissima Trinità dei Monti, go straight to the third chapel on the right there, and enjoy a masterpiece by Daniele da Volterra. Well, join me there with my Professor of Fine Arts, Breda Ennis.
It's a chapel of Lucrezia della Rovere. Yes. What we're looking at is a fresco. The della Rovere family presumably commissioned the artist Daniele da Volterra to paint this. Mm. Daniele da Volterra dates back to what period?
The middle 1500s, 1548 or so. There was a question mark about whether he physically did the painting, but he certainly designed the whole painting, the fresco.
The fresco is huge. There's a lot going on. Correct me if I'm wrong, Breda. I mean, what strikes you most is Our Lady surrounded by little angels who look as if they're playing Ring a Ring of Roses around her in the clouds there. And then there's an earthly dimension as well. Should we start with Our Lady?
Yes. Well, just before that, there's something, if you look at it closely, it's more than just what they call an altar painting. The fresco takes up the entire wall, above and below and the sides of the altar itself. But it's also a trompe l'oeil, which means that you have these false pillars, which look real from a distance. Strange, you just right behind the altar, you have two figures reading the sacred scriptures. So they look like almost they're leaning on the altar as well and reading the scriptures. Then go above that.
It's a very modern way of depicting.
Yes, it's very, it's just
isn't that very modern for 1500s?
Yes, in fact, but this is the mannerist painting, but it's the kind of painting you would generally see essentially on a ceiling. There are little elements also of Michelangelo in this. You can feel in certain figures the way people are posing and looking and pensive and intellectual or bemused or confused or perplexed, all these different types of emotions. Predominance of blues and golds. But
and pinks.
And pinks as well, and greens. And then white, obviously. And then just above that, obviously they must be reading about the Assumption of the Virgin, because up above them you have a totally separate scene where the Virgin is sitting on a cloud and she is about to go up into the heavens. But what's unusual about this, it's almost like he did a sort of a circle, an oval circle, a bit like the top of a cup, you know. You just feel like she's levitating, going right up through, and she's going to disappear into an area that we can't see. But it's very cleverly done, the artist here, because you really get the feeling that there's an enormous area that you don't see, but you perceive. Now, and she is dressed in the most beautiful celestial blue, and she has her hands raised, and she's surrounded by gold and white. It's almost like she's slowly, slowly, slowly going up into heaven.
How'd you get that effect?
Yeah, well, he's doing it by the perspective. If you notice also the columns that are painted on the wall, which look like they're supposed to be the columns in the chapel, false columns, obviously. Look behind and you see more pillars. He made it look like she's inside a type of temple. So you get the feeling she's going up through the columns, going up through the roof, which is open, and right up into the sky. But there, it's all a flat wall, so it's all to do with the illusionistic painting, very much like Pozzo, who painted the convent next door. What's interesting is just below you have the angels around her accompanying her, and they're all joining hands with each other. It's almost like they're playing Ring a Ring a Rosie around the Virgin. It's a strange feeling because they're all doing it backwards. They're looking out from the painting, all with their arms joined. And you get the feeling there's a vortex, a sense of circular movement, strong, strong circular movement. So it's almost like she's being pushed up into the heavens. Again, strangely enough, modern, you were saying before. Think of Matisse and his dancers. These angels, they're not dissimilar.
You were listening there to Professor of Fine Arts, Breda Ennis, currently working at the American University of Rome, and also an artist herself. Finally, here in Rome once again, we join historian Stella Fletcher to speak of two terribly English poets.
Here lies one whose name was written water. This is a clue for our listeners who probably have guessed who we're about to speak about. Stella.
He's one of our most famous poets, and his tomb lies here in the English cemetery, sometimes referred to as the Acattolico, or rather the non-Catholic cemetery.
Well, the full inscription on the tomb of Keats reads, "This grave contains all that was mortal of a young English poet, who, on his deathbed, in bitter anguish at the neglect of his countrymen, desired these words to be engraved on his tombstone. Here lies one whose name was writ in water." It was only those last few words that Keats actually wanted to appear on the tomb. He didn't want his name on it at all, just those words. I think it indicates the transience of life. If you were to write your name in water, the water would close as soon as your finger had moved through it. Keats lived for only 26 years, so his life was more transient than most, even in his own day. So how come Keats came to Rome to die? Effectively, that's what he did. In 1820, it was clear that he was suffering from tuberculosis, consumption. And many people in that period suffered that dreadful disease and were sent to warmer climes, particularly to Italy, for the good of their health. That's precisely what happened to Keats. So in the late autumn of 1820, he and his friend, the artist Joseph Seven, set out by sea. A long, long voyage. And eventually they arrived in Naples. He spent a few days there and then made the journey up to Rome. In Rome, they made the acquaintance of an English doctor called James Clark, who lived near Piazza di Spagna and knew of an apartment where the two young men could stay. Keats and Seven lived in the apartment at Piazza di Spagna for 3 or 4 months. His health improved initially, but in January it declined, and in February it was clear that the end was nigh. A few days before he died, he sent Joseph Seven down here to the Protestant cemetery to see
what it was like. And Seven reported back, and Keats thought, yes, I think I should be happy there. So he died in February 1821. Now, we mentioned that this was the non-Catholic cemetery, and indeed the non-Catholics in Rome at that date had a pretty tough time of it. Those who died here had to be buried before daylight. When Keats died, they started out from Piazza di Spagna in the dark. By the time the little ceremony with just a few people was over, it was 9 a.m.
Percy Bysshe Shelley is also buried in this same cemetery. They're linked in death, aren't they?
Linked in death more so than in life. There was a contact between them. Shelley was living in Italy when Keats fell ill with consumption. Shelley did, in fact, invite Keats to stay with him in Italy, but that was about the extent of the connection. More or less, their deaths fell just months apart. Shelley was drowned at sea near Viareggio, in territory belonging to the ex-Republic of Italy. His body was washed ashore on the beach there. Now, there was great confusion over what was to be done with this body of a foreign national. It was eventually decided that it couldn't be removed from the beach, but instead they would have a funeral pyre on the beach. Byron was there. Shelley's wife, his widow, wasn't. It was thought to be too sensitive for women to be present. But a few friends were there on the beach, and they burnt his body. As his chest burst open, one friend reached into the flames and removed the heart. It was a peculiarly large heart. Anyway, over there in the other part of the cemetery, what we actually have is a tomb containing the heart of Shelley plus his ashes. Now, he had little to do with this cemetery, little to do with Rome. He lived elsewhere. But it so happened that a few years earlier, the Shelleys had been passing through Rome and their son died. Their son was buried here. It's unclear quite where, because when a tomb was dug up and investigated, it was found to contain the body of an adult and not a child. So there's a bit of confusion involved there.
Zilla, these two poets were linked in death for another reason as well, no?
When Shelley's body was found washed up on the beach, he had the published poems of Keats in his pocket. They were more connected in death than in life.
There's also another link, and that's the water link.
Ah, here lies one whose name was writ in water.
You were listening there to historian Stella Fletcher. And that's all we have time for. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks for listening. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. You've been listening to the English programme of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.